If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome to our podcast,
Life After the Letters. I'm Amelie.
And I'm Suba.
We're friends that met whilst working our first shifts as junior doctors.
And we're here to talk about the stories and challenges that we face every day.
I'm so excited to introduce the next guest to you. Her name is Maya Zosma, and her path to medicine was a windy one. She's a testament to those who say, and rightfully so, that medicine is both an art and a science. Maya studied architecture initially and has been releasing music and playing gigs with her band for the past 10 years. She then went on to study medicine and is currently taking time out of training to pursue humanitarian work both here in the UK and abroad in the infamous refugee camp of Lesbos. Hello, Suba and Maya.
Hi.
It always excites me when we have more than one other person in the studio.
And it's very exciting. And also to learn so much about Maya. So I had no idea that Maya had all these interesting like side hustles going on. Because I met you very randomly in the hospital canteen.
Yes, with a mutual friend. We had a great lunch.
Yeah, and all I learned about Maya during that like hour was just that you used to do this intense squat challenge to the tune of Fort Myers.
Yes, yes, we did.
You know, the 100% song.
So nothing to show for it.
Don't sell yourself short, Maya. But then now to find out that you went to architecture school and you do all this work with like the refugees.
And then medical school.
Yeah.
I think you make me sound a bit cooler than I am.
So yeah, actually tell us why you decided to study architecture in the first place, because it seems like you've done loads of random things.
I have, yeah, I really have. At school I just really loved art, so I wanted to do something creative, but also I really like science. I was always a bit like, my A levels were like chemistry and art and English. Everyone was like, what are you doing with your life? And then I kind of like found architecture would be a really nice balance between that love of art and something a bit more scientific, I guess. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So did you go straight into architecture then?
Yes, I went to Sheffield University to do architecture. It was
and
really good fun.
How many years was that?
3 years.
Okay. And then you decided that you didn't have enough studying. So
when I finished architecture, it was 2008, so the recession just started. So there was no jobs. So a lot of us were applying and not really finding anything. So I worked for a bit kind of in related fields. So I was working like a furniture workshop. I learned how to build like furniture out of leather.
That's cool.
More randomness for you. And then in that time, I started thinking maybe this is not for me. Like, I want to work with people. And I took a job as a receptionist in a clinic in King's College Hospital.
Okay.
And then I decided this is maybe what I want to do. So I applied for medicine, didn't get in.
Okay, so relatively shortly after.
Yeah. I worked for a bit. I was waitressing for a bit. I was a receptionist for a bit, did random bits, and then tried to get into medicine, couldn't get in, and applied again the next year. Uh-huh. Managed to get onto like a foundation course at Bradford, which had a link into Leeds Medical School. While I was doing that course at Bradford, I actually applied again to graduate entry courses, and I managed to get a place at Keele Medical School.
And oh, you have the same course as me, structure, because exactly, I went to Manchester.
Yeah. So then I got into Kiel, so that was great.
So had you thought about medicine as a career prior to ever working as a receptionist?
Yeah, I did. I wanted to do medicine when I was at school, but I think I probably thought I can't do it. You know, I didn't think I'd be able to get into med school, so, and I thought I'd just pursue my art mind. Mm-hmm. But then I guess after architecture, I thought maybe I kind of got drawn back into it.
Yeah. Why didn't you think that you couldn't go into it, or why did you have that mindset at the time?
I think I didn't. At my school, it was very much like the top students went to med school. I was never a top student. It was very much like they directed those people to go.
Yeah.
So I didn't see myself as part of that cohort maybe at the time. And you don't really know what you're doing when you're at school.
I think we've spoken about that before, actually. The fact that you almost get like sort of handpicked to be like the school's nomination for medical school. It's ridiculous.
Everyone knows who went to med school from your year and things like that.
Totally. So, and who applied before the 15th of October for Oxford and Cambridge.
It's sort of elitist kind of. I think it's really bad, actually, because I don't think anyone should feel that they aren't good enough for med school, because so many people that, you know, you might have all the accomplishments on paper, but you know, it may not suit you. It may not be what you want to do, but you just end up kind of getting pushed onto the conveyor belt.
And then people leave in the middle of med school, so because it's not really for them. No. But maybe I would have gone there earlier. Maybe that would have been a bad idea. I needed that break. So.
No, that time is useful as well. But aren't both your parents doctors?
Yeah. So obviously they were keen for me to
were they so this is an interesting thing. I mean, not to digress too much, but like, would you guys want your kids to do medicine?
I mean, I don't know, I feel like I'd want them to choose their own path.
That was beautiful.
That was very cliche. I think I am really happy that I'm a doctor. I don't think I would do anything else. But if it's not for you, it's really not the job for you. So I think you really need to be suited to it. I don't know, what do you think?
Well, like for me, my dad actually told me, Ned, why don't you explore your different options? And actually, initially, I wanted to go to America because they've got a wider education system over there. So you kind of just choose a couple of things. So I applied. I did my ACTs, I did my SATs. And I actually so I actually did really well, just because what we were doing at A-level was far above what they were doing in America at that age. Yeah. So it was more like GCSE level kind of stuff. So I was like,
I got this in the bag. They're really hard, but then, test called the SAT was just so simple for me.
Perfect score. No, so I then applied and I got into two places.
Where? But stop being so coy.
I'm going to be coy. But the fees are so expensive.
Yeah, tell them.
But like ridiculous.
Yeah. You get outpriced.
As in like my parents would have had to really sell their house.
Like, no, it's ridiculous. I think that higher education in America, you just get outpriced. You can't afford it. Because I had a friend that applied to American colleges back in the days, and she like had to have, but like, she had to have financial aid. So, and they do have a lot of good financial aid programs though.
Especially if you're like, you're into sports and things like that. Yeah. They've got really good scholarships for people. Yeah. But actually, if you just study, then that's all you can do.
No scholarships for you.
You better have some money.
Yeah, you've got to be really well-rounded, haven't you, there? I can so imagine you going to like an American. I feel like it really would have suited you.
Aw, maybe I would have found American Bay. But I'm going to stop talking about I need to stop talking about my search for Bay on this show, because otherwise we need to change the title of it. So clearly you are interested in other things outside of medicine that are complemented by your career. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about the work that you've been doing over the past year?
So I took an F3 year, and I had quite a few ideas what to do, but like most people, I wasn't very organised. I've been working in elderly care as a SHO, but then I also travelled to Lesbos, which is one of the Greek islands. There's a big refugee camp there called Moria, and I was there for a month working as a doctor in a clinic, and I'm planning to go back actually in a month. And some of the other things I've been doing, I've been working on a project based on some data that I collected as an F2 to improve the care and the patient journey of homeless patients in our hospital. So I've been kind of like dipping in and out of things that I've that interested me that I never really had a chance to pursue. And then also I'm doing a diploma in medical care of catastrophes, which is really interesting, disaster medicine. And yeah, I guess.
And you're also learning Arabic, aren't you?
Yes, yeah, I did a course in Arabic. Yeah.
You're actually crazy, I've just realised.
On a side note, casual side note, casual. Learning Arabic.
Yeah, it's I did that because I knew I was going back to the camp, so yeah. I thought, not that I could do the work without an interpreter, but having a little bit of Arabic kind of help, I think will help me. Yeah.
Did you always know that you were going to go into refugee work?
No, not at all. No. I think I started getting interested in the refugee, I don't want to say refugee crisis, because that's, I don't really like that term. Mm-hmm. But it kind of really like touched a nerve with me. I felt like I wanted to know more about it. I felt like I needed to do something. And I just started searching around, seeing what work is out there. I think, you know, as a doctor, you know, you have this skill that you can give. And I thought, well, I could use that. Go and get myself, basically understand it more and maybe help a tiny bit. Like, you can't really make a big difference. But, you know, it's every little thing, I guess, you know. I've lost my chain of thought there.
So before you went out to Moria, what did you like anticipate it would be like? What was kind of concerns in your mind about how things would be, and how was it when you actually got there?
Yeah, so actually I had no idea what to expect, and I was incredibly nervous. You don't really know, you know, how the camp is going to be. You don't know what the NGO that you're working with is going to be like. I've never done humanitarian work before, so I was really, really nervous. I was like reading up about it as much as I could. When I got there, I could not have pictured what I saw. It was actually way worse than what I thought it was going to be, particularly because I thought, well, you know, I'm going to Greece, it's Europe, there's going to be some kind of standards. But actually it was, the conditions were really horrendous. And the problems that we saw in the clinic were not what I thought they would be. So that was a bit shocking to me, very overwhelming at the beginning. Got a little bit easier towards kind of after I'd been there for a week or two, but it was really tough. It was an experience that I think is quite, almost life-changing for me. Yeah.
And can I ask, what was the setup of the camp like?
So there's 7,000 people there at the moment, around 7,000. But the camp is it's a military base, and it's only built for about 2,000 people. So it's very overcrowded. People live in, some of them live in these ISO boxes, which are kind of like shipping containers. But there's obviously way more people than there are ISO boxes. So there's lots of tents. And then there's a massive overspill area outside the camp, which is called the Olive Grove, which is just loads and loads of tents. There is kind of basic facilities. There's running water intermittently. Electricity, I'm not really sure what the picture is with electricity. In our clinic, we didn't have running water. And I'm not really sure about heating and things like that. It's one of those things that, you know, you kind of hear from the refugees, like what their situation is, where they're living. But every person has a slightly different kind of a living arrangement. So some people have access to more than others.
But still not very much.
No, not very much. There's just not enough facilities, living space, kind of area for the people that are living there. There's obviously not enough provisions of healthcare. There's our clinic, there's a couple of other clinics, but it's very, very scarce on the ground.
And you said that you weren't quite prepared for the types of conditions and things that you would come in contact with. What did you mean by that?
I didn't realise how overcrowded it would be. There's very little dignity. Hygiene is a real issue. We saw a lot of scabies in the clinic. That was very difficult to get on top of because there's no washing facilities for clothes. There's children in the camp, there's like young families, and the camp is very dangerous, especially at nighttime for women and children. And I didn't quite understand that before I got there. You don't really think of the kind of the impact of putting so many people together in such a small space, and people who have been through so much trauma and people who are from so many different backgrounds and cultures. So I think that was quite overwhelming when I got there. Yeah.
How did you find, from like a medical perspective, were you support? Did you have a lot of senior support? Did you feel like you kind of had the capacity within yourself to manage conditions you were seeing? Or did you find that some of the things you were seeing were things that you weren't maybe used to seeing here? And also, I mean, just as a quick background, what jobs did you do as an F1 and an F2? So yeah, what was the lead up?
Oh, sorry. So I did, what did I do? Vascular surgery, psychiatry and stroke. Mm-hmm. Then F2, I did pediatrics, A&E. See, it's traumatized me so much, I had to think about that. And AMU.
Okay, that's and a really good mix of jobs.
Very good mix.
Really good mix, yeah.
Yeah, and then I went into elderly care and then I went to the camp, yeah. What was the other question?
So sorry.
Medical.
Yeah. From a medical point of view, did you feel supported and were the things you were seeing things you felt comfortable managing?
Mm. So actually, I didn't realise how much mental health there would be. It was completely disproportionate to the kind of the amount of patients we saw in the clinic. Most of the cases that we saw were mental health related. Most people just struggle to sleep there because they go through kind of trauma, they've got PTSD. Apart from that kind of stuff, we had your basic primary care presentation. So like UTIs, chest infections, you know, headaches, pain conditions, things like that, reflux. I didn't feel as supported as I thought I would be. Mm. There is a Greek doctor working there. I guess the way that they work there is a little bit different to the way that we work here. Mm-hmm. Also, you can't do the things that you would do back home at the camp. In terms of you can't send everyone for blood tests. Mm-hmm. You can't send everyone into hospital. There's just no capacity on the island for that. You have to be a little bit careful with who you call in ambulances for, because there is a little bit of a worry that ambulances will just stop coming into the camp if you call them too much. Mm. So you have to do as much as you can in the camp with the limited resources that you have. Mm. Mental health wise, there's not much you can do at all.
Yeah, I was going to ask because, I mean, for so many things, you might want to refer them for like counselling, things like that. And is that an option?
There is a referral system in place to have psychology. But the waiting lists are huge. These patients have been there for, I don't think people realise that these refugees actually stay in these camps for months and maybe years, just waiting for their asylum process to be processed. So you can refer them. I don't know how much help that psychology service was, because it's very basic. There are a lot of other NGOs in the camp that do kind of community projects. So there was another NGO that like opened a library and ran like stress classes in different languages. So that would, that's what we focused our management on. We were basically kind of encouraging them to say, okay, like, you know, basically empowering them. I guess they've been through so much and managed to get themselves to Europe, to this camp. It's kind of like they probably know more about resilience and kind of healing than we can kind of teach them. So you kind of build on that, you kind of empower them and say, you know, go to the library, go for a walk. I used to say to them, take an hour walk every day, just have a routine, do something with your day, you know. And it was really actually amazing how they took on that advice, because they're incredibly strong group of people. So that's kind of where we aimed our management plans at. You can't give medication because first of all, there's a real risk of overdose, and second of all, it might create a black market within the camp. So you have to be very, very careful with medication. Only in extreme cases, we might give some lorazepam, but very, very extreme. You can't really send anyone away with any of those kind of medications. So you just have to basically empower them to, I don't know, help themselves, help each other as well. They really, really helped each other. It's very difficult. It's very, very difficult managing those kind of presentations in the camp, because you know that they're going back to the same issues that brought them in. So some of the mental health problems were to do with the trauma that they've experienced from where they were fleeing from, or the trauma they've experienced en route. Mm-hmm. And that is perpetuated by the conditions in the camp. Mm-hmm. So it's almost a no-win situation. So you have to really empower them, and you know, it's really impressive the amount of hope and resilience that they have, actually. Yeah.
And you said that there were other NGOs working within the same camp. What was the support and what resources were available to refugees, essentially? Mm.
So there was an NGO providing food. There was an NGO that provided some educational stuff for the kids in the camp. There is another camp that's kind of has more families in it. So they had, I think, a formal system of schooling. I don't think there was one in Moria, but I might be wrong. Or that might have changed since I've got there. What else did they have? Sort of community projects. So there's an NGO called Refugee for Refugees, who are incredible. I worked with them when I was there as well. They're kind of some of them are volunteers from abroad. Some of them are refugees that live in the camp. And they basically curated what they had at the time was a clothes distribution. So they would collect all the clothes, donations, kind of sort them, and then people could come from the camp and kind of get some new clothes and things. But they also did a lot of community work, community projects, kind of things with the kids. There's lots of small projects going on. There's another big NGO that had a whole community centre quite near the camp. So they had, I don't know exactly what they had there because I never managed to go there, but they had activities for the kids, activities for women. There's NGOs that do classes, so like Greek classes, English classes, IT classes, kind of things aimed at integrating people into the community and help them kind of if they're going to stay in Greece, help them kind of integrate into the society. So it's kind of really amazing stuff that's been done there.
And it's clearly quite life-changing stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
How do you think it's changed your practice, particularly coming back to the UK after being there for such a long time?
It's difficult because I kind of imagine myself going back and having to deal with some shouting people in A&E telling me that they've been waiting for too long. And you kind of think, oh, you're so lucky to have the NHS. It's such an amazing thing. I did find it difficult at the beginning. I think maybe, how did it change the way that I practice? I guess I'm like, for myself, I'm like really grateful that we have this service. Mm-hmm. And I'm almost like amazed at some of the things that we can do. And maybe I have more patience for people as well, because in the clinic, people have to wait for hours to see a doctor. And there's a lot of fighting outside the clinic, and they can get really, really aggressive. And you have to keep reminding yourself, like, what these people have been through and the situation that they're in, and you try and kind of be patient with them. And that's quite hard sometimes. But I think it really, like, taught me that kind of step back, just be patient. There is a reason why somebody is behaving in the way that they are, sometimes, not all the time. Yeah, and I think in elderly care, I think that's another part of our society that needs, that needs kind of the welfare system and things like that. And I'm like really grateful for that,
and
I'm really happy about that.
And
time
and patience from the doctors as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I don't know if it made me like a better doctor, but it just kind of made me more appreciative of what we have and more grateful. Yeah.
Do you find that you're now really stringent with sending people for blood tests and stuff, because you can appreciate, like,
I knew a silly question was coming
from like my expression on my face. I was like, so do you find that you are, because I wonder sometimes if we're so used to just, you know, like having the luxury of being able to be like, well, you can have a chest x-ray, so you know, and I guess it will rule out this one differential diagnosis, which I don't really think you have, but here you go, here's a chest x-ray, which if you were in more resource environments, you wouldn't do, because you cannot do.
Yeah. I don't do CRPs very much.
There you go.
And they're expensive.
And our trust is like literally always reminding us that they're expensive and that we don't need to do them every day.
Yeah. But I think that's also maybe like an experience, because I think when you're an F1, you kind of put out all the blood tests for everyone because you don't really know what you'll need. Whereas maybe with more experience, you think actually a CRP is not going to change my management, so it's just a waste of money. But I think, I don't know, I don't think I'm more stringent. I just think maybe like, you think a bit more about kind of things that you're doing.
Yeah. Like I used to go to all the MSF talks when I was at university, and I remember whenever the doctors who had been working in these camps abroad came back to the UK, they said that actually working in these areas allowed them to become better clinicians, because you had to rely on the history, you had to rely on your examination. And actually blood tests and investigations, they just tend to confirm what your diagnosis likely is. So yeah, they said having the luxury of these things when they came back helped their practice, but it wasn't all they relied on anymore.
Yeah, definitely. Although I think I need a bit more clinical experience before I get to that stage, you know.
I was wondering, has it made you consider more of a general training path now?
In order
to be able to be a better clinician for refugee work?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think I'm really interested in refugee medicine and kind of inclusion health in general. But GP would lend itself quite well to that. Mm. But I just really love medicine. So I'm kind of really, really drawn to just doing CMT and going down that path and finding myself within that somewhere. I think it's where my heart is at the moment, where my passion is. So I think pursue and don't regret, maybe.
Exactly. And I mean, yeah. You can always... there's always flexibility at the end of the day, which you've really shown us. You know, in practice rather than
maybe
went a little bit overboard
with that. Yeah.
So tell us a bit about your homelessness project. So what was this initially, like a little QI project?
Here we go.
QI projects aren't just for the CV.
Exactly. Yeah. So when we were in A&E, they told us we had to do an audit. So I kind of wasn't really sure what I was going to do it on, but I don't know, in our A&E department, maybe probably most of A&E departments, overnight you just get loads of people sleeping in the waiting room. And everyone's like, oh, they're the homeless people, you know, try and move them out and things. And I don't know, that really got to me. So I thought, okay, let's find out the numbers.
They move them out so aggressively sometimes. Yeah. And I'm just like...
Yeah.
I thought there was sort of like a symbiotic relationship where we just know that at 4 o'clock that corner is reserved.
Yeah. Like, just leave them.
Yeah, like, I'm sorry, but the two back rows are taken, sir.
Exactly.
Find another seat. Okay.
Like, some people do not have beds to go to, so this is their bedroom, okay?
It's a 2-hour waiting time. It's not that bad. You can sit in front.
Those seats might be more comfortable than the actual, like, trolleys in the A&E. Yeah, so I thought they're not really harming anyone. I mean, so I just wanted to get the numbers, get some, like, data on, like, who these patients are, why are they coming, what are we doing with them. So yeah, I just kind of started collecting data about basically anyone that comes into A&E with, you know, on the system it says like no fixed abode or hostel accommodation. So I sort of picked up all of those patients over like a 6-month period. Okay. And looked at them, why they were coming, whether they were staying in hospital, how they were being discharged. Repeat attendances, yeah. That was a massive thing.
What are
some
of the things that you learned from that study?
So most of the stuff is probably what you'd expect. So what they come in with is things that are related to kind of having a chaotic lifestyle. So, you know, mental health problems, injuries and intoxication. Mm-hmm. But what I didn't realise was how much they were coming back. So within the 6 months period, quite a lot of them came back. So obviously the problems were still ongoing. And I feel that the basis of that is probably because they are, you know, they don't have like a stable somewhere to go home to, basically. And I kind of started researching into it. And obviously, I think we all know that there's these indiscrepancies between health and homeless people and the general population. And I got in touch with a big charity called Pathway, and they have some really interesting projects in terms of homelessness and health. So... putting in advocates into hospitals for homeless patients, trying to pick them up in hospital, because these are vulnerable people.
Yeah.
To pick them in hospital, you know, get them set up with a GP, try and get them some housing. And basically I wanted to use my project as a business case to get an advocate for the hospital.
Yeah.
So that is what I'm working on at the moment.
Okay.
That's a project at the moment. Yeah.
And have you found that people meet that with, like, a positive response, people are willing to get involved in that, or people quite dismissive?
So no, actually, when I speak to other doctors, everyone says yes, like, we need someone like that. There are a lot of homeless people that we don't really know what to do with them. We end up sending them back onto the streets. It doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
I did write a business case. I I sent it to this competition that they had. It wasn't successful, but one of my consultants kind of was really interested in it, is picking it up for me and trying to get
and
some
the
funding.
And the right consultant.
The right consultant, yeah.
I think
yeah.
We all know who that is.
We're all looking very conspiratorially around yeah. each other, like, what?
Yeah, so...
The most powerful man in the hospital.
Yeah, luckily I'm kind of, you know, working with him, so I kind of sent it his way. And he's trying to take the project forward to get some funding for me, so... Yeah, should be yeah. exciting. If
he
I get
would love
that.
To hear that we just refer to him in that way.
I think you should get him in.
Yeah, I would love to.
Yeah, so we'll see what happens.
No, that's great, because yeah. I think so often, like, you know, throughout our...
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Times we'll all have an experience that kind of really sticks in your mind, but we don't always end up taking it forward and running with it and like making a change out of it. And maybe that's because we get bogged down with other things and you get distracted and, you know... Yeah. Life gets in the way, but it's fantastic to see that you're like really taking that forward and making a change.
Yeah, but you're right. I started the project in 2016, so
no, it takes time.
It's very, very slow, and
you've also been doing a great amount of work in between that as well. When you think about it, like yesterday when I was talking to Hazel, the food medic, about what she had been doing. Actually, she was really interested in nutrition and exercise and health medicine. That she started doing her own research and reading into it. Mm. And actually it's very difficult to do that at the same time as taking a full-time career as a doctor. Mm. So she needed some sort of time out to be able to pursue that properly. Mm. And that's what you've been doing as well. So I think it is a real testament to following your passions and doing something outside of the norm.
And these things always take time, you know, these things don't change overnight and there's so many processes you've got to go through and so many people you need to speak with, and it's just about
being
quite persistent quite persistent and just not
giving up.
Exactly.
Definitely. Keep pushing.
So we've spoken about the burden of homelessness in our communities. Subu, have you ever had any dealings with people who have no fixed abode or... And find it difficult to manage them because of that.
Yeah, and I think, interestingly, because it touches on the fact that I've obviously just come off my A&E job, and you speak about how often they repeat attend. And actually, over the course of 4 months, I feel like there's patients that I see more often than some friends. No, honestly. And, it as much as it's actually quite nice, because I think that they kind of, I feel like, and people do this when they're going through a lot of hardship, but sometimes they take it in a very, like, tongue-in-cheek way, and they're actually very funny, and because you kind of have to be, right? Otherwise you're just going to be depressed, so it goes one of each ways. And I remember there's this one patient I used to see very often, and he'd often come in intoxicated, and it used to make me really sad, because I was like, he's really young, and you know, we had a long conversation once where he then sort of spoke to me about recent bereavement, and you know that since then things had really spiraled out of control, and he'd really lost like his sort of like safety net, and like the balance that he had in the world kind of really went out. And since then, he had kind of spiraled into this whole thing. And, you know, we were talking about it, and he had kind of actually gone through all the right processes. He'd been referred to, like, the alcohol service. He'd seen a, you know, a therapist, but just none of it had been quite right for him. And now he was very sort of like, just, you know, didn't have a lot of faith in any of it anymore. Didn't think anything would ever change for him, and had become very like, well, whatever. Like, this is just my life now. And he just had such an attitude of like, meh, like, this is just it now. And maybe it was just me being very naive and maybe a bit perky after my second cup of coffee at 2 a.m. And I was just like, no, your life's going to be fine and you're going to be okay. And, you know, trying to be like, you've just got to, you know, like, get back on the track. And but as much as I was saying that, it's like, I could appreciate that I was in no place to be telling this guy anything about life when, like, from what experience am I coming to speak to him? But I kind of just wanted to be able to, like, I don't know, kind of say, like, I don't know, maybe just kind of give him some sort of hope in that moment, because he seemed very hopeless.
Yeah, and I think you're also acknowledging all the good work that he has done as well.
Yeah.
Because, and I think it goes back to what Maya was saying earlier when she was saying that actually these refugees that she meets have a lot of hope, and they've clearly had a lot of resilience to even get to the camp in the first place. So actually, we do need to be a voice to acknowledge what they've been doing as well.
Exactly.
So sometimes it does come across naive to them, but it's difficult to know how to communicate that clearly sometimes.
Yeah, there's also a lot of isolation with homelessness. So coming into hospital might be their only contact with another person who speaks to them as a person, not as a homeless person. People just walk past most of the time. So actually, that is probably a really positive experience for someone. And there are a lot of problems with the housing situation and getting people back on their feet. But I think, if the one thing that you say, it will probably stick with him, and maybe he'll do something different next time or something. And I think also, I think that's why I feel the advocate role is really important, because it's quite big expectation to expect someone to just pick themselves up and find a job and all of this when they've, so I think just having the advocate, having someone help them navigate the system, having, and also as a hospital, I think we are kind of in a position where we see a lot of vulnerable people. So if we can do something to kind of push them in the right direction, I think it's, even if it's something really small, like telling him, no, you can do this. You know, you're probably stuck with him, you know.
Absolutely. I think sometimes it's that, I suppose, kind of touching on what you said, Amelie, like, I think that I could sense in him that as much as he was coming across as almost a bit hopeless, I felt like he wasn't. And maybe just in that moment, he had just maybe run out of fuel, and he was just tired of having to try all the time. And I felt like maybe he just needed a bit of like an external power up. So that was kind of me. and that was the first time I saw him. And then like I saw him, you know, a few more times after that. And the last time I saw him, I remember being like, oh, I remember you. Like, do you remember me? Because he was, you know, it was quite intoxicated the first few times, and he was like, yeah, I do remember you. And I was like, oh,
yes,
hey. And I thought that was an interesting thing, because I mean, sometimes you don't see people again, even though you know they probably have come back in. But when you do see people again and again, the interesting was the last time that I saw him, you know, and he was like, I remember what we spoke about and blah, blah, blah. And he was like, you're not going to see me again. And, you know, and he was like really motivated. And I actually didn't see him again.
Oh, wow.
And I hope that's a good thing. And I hope that he's, you know, maybe picked himself up a bit and he's doing well. But
you might have made a real difference there.
I mean, who knows? I hope so.
And maybe I'll just say while I'm here, if you do see patients in A&E and if they want help, you can ask them where they actually, if they are homeless, where they're sleeping. There's an app called StreetLink. Has anyone heard of it?
Yeah.
It's a free app. You download it. It's brilliantly designed. You just say, this is where they're sleeping. Describe them a little bit. And then there's outreach teams, and they come and have a chat to them, say, these are the services available for you. And then if they want to engage, they can. If they don't want to engage, they don't have to. I've used it quite a few times, and sometimes you get emails back saying, oh, the person that you referred to us is now engaged in local services. So you kind of see the feedback. So, you know, I would really recommend getting that app if you want.
I think it's interesting you've mentioned that app, particularly in relation to the homeless patients. When I was in psychiatry, we used to have to use StreetLink a lot, and it was just purely because we weren't able to house certain patients who, for example, didn't have a didn't have, who hadn't paid taxes essentially for a number of years. So we weren't able to provide them with that, even like the halfway housing, for example. And StreetLink was really useful in order to get them linked in with some sort of social worker or someone who could point them to the right services. Because actually these people don't have access to the internet. They can't search things as easy as we can. So it was really useful to have them in contact with an expert. But it's such a shame that these are the only available things. So I think advocacy work is really important. And yeah, that'd be great if I could see that with more A&Es.
Yeah, for sure.
Cool, Maya.
We'll see what happens. There's always hope. With people like Suba telling people they can...
Me just telling people off in a motivational way. But I wanted to also touch on the fact that you spoke about how obviously there's a health disparity with the homeless population, and how, of course, you know, we can see them for things like injuries, intoxication, and I think unfortunately sometimes like different doctors have different levels of tolerance for different presenting complaints. And there's a lot of people that just see intoxication and already like rolling their eyes and going with very much an attitude of like, you're wasting my time.
CT head and out.
Yeah, which I think is such a shame sometimes. But I do appreciate, I don't know, I do
appreciate. But it is a shame because it almost, because that's the accepted culture in the hospital and also the world. So if it, actually the seniors are the ones to be like, oh, whatever, CT head, fluids, kick him out. Yeah. It's just, it feels so unnerving when you see that as a junior doctor because you want to help out a little bit more without having that label of being naive.
It has to come from the top.
But it has to come from the top.
You need that push to say, this is important, we should be focusing on this. Actually, when I started looking into it, there's the basically a new act as part of the homelessness reduction bill. So it's already come into place, but basically hospitals, because they are public authorities, will have a duty to kind of do something to reduce homelessness and to reduce threatened homelessness. So hopefully there will be a push for, you know, practical stuff to be done, but who knows, I don't really understand how these things
How do you shift the culture though for us to start accepting homelessness as an important thing to care for?
I guess I did a talk in the AMU teaching and people said, oh yeah, actually, the respiratory consultants and the respiratory team were like, yes, actually, our TB patients, you know, they cause us a lot of problems.
This was literally what I was going to come to.
I was about to talk about TB patients.
I was going to come to that.
Yeah. So they said, yes, you know, we've had these patients stay in hospital for such a long time because we can't send them home. So I think I tried to go along the financial incentive side because that's how I get the money for the advocate. So I tried, basically I looked into waiting times in A&E. I looked into bed days and the cost of bed days. That's not the way I think, but that's the way I've shifted my thinking.
Where you have to think, unfortunately.
Because this is how we get money moving into getting this kind of project. So I genuinely think there is a financial incentive to get to tackle the problem. And I don't know, I guess just saying, you know, there are really easy things that you can do. The StreetLink app is so easy. It takes like 2 minutes to fill it out. I don't just use it at work. I use it when I'm out in the street as well. I think when you actually ask someone, you know, they will, I think most doctors will have the same views that we do.
Of course.
It's just that when you're under pressure in A&E and you've got someone coming in intoxicated, it's, you know, you kind of lose that empathy maybe. But it's just, I don't know, maybe continuing to drive in the message without kind of driving people crazy.
And I think it's also important to kind of push yourself to always remain present in your work. Now actually, when you talk about your experience, Suba, with that gentleman who came in a couple of times, had you not been present with him initially, you may not have remembered him the second or the third time, and you may have never actually built that connection. So I think it is important for us to build connections with our patients because that's the way in which you can...
That's why we did medicine, really, I mean.
Yeah, that's the bottom line. I mean, even when, you know, even I remember the first time I went to see him, I remember, you know, acknowledging, like, myself when I first read the presenting complaint. It was a bit of a, you know, internal eye roll as I go. And as I get there and he's sleeping and I'm like, hello, hello. And you're like, oh,
hello, I'm hit, please.
Yeah, you know, and then, but then it was actually, you know, when you then start communicating and you kind of feel like, I don't know, there's like a degree of embarrassment and shame from him, and then you can kind of resonate with that, and you're like, oh, okay. And then the relationship builds and you build the rapport. But I think having that experience for me, when I then approach patients in the future, I'm always a lot more like, check myself and check my own sort of attitudes when I'm going in. But I wanted to speak about how people that come in homeless also have quite serious medical conditions like TB, because I think one of the saddest cases I ever saw, and probably the only time I think I've actually cried in the hospital, which I'm quite proud of, like, I'm sorry, but it's the only time I cried in hospital.
Wow, that is impressive.
I know, right? I've been very close. I've been like, you know, eyes brimming. But this time a few tears actually rolled down the cheek.
Did you not go into the sluice room? And
I didn't. I literally cried.
I pretending that I'm testing urine when I'm actually like...
desperately sobbing over the sluice.
So sad.
We had a friend called David who worked with us in A&E, and he used to fill his scrub pockets with chocolate to find crying people in the sluice room.
Oh, that's so nice.
Yeah. But you know, when you're like,
him.
Yeah, exactly.
He was great.
But you know, when you're like, oh, that is a problem with A&E.
Yeah.
Like, that shouldn't be the norm.
Yeah. I'm surprised that I've not come across anyone crying in a cupboard or anything. But but no, this, it was so sad. I cried like in front of the patient. It was, I mean, I don't think they realized I'm a very secretive crier. So it was a guy I'd seen who'd come in, and I think it was his attitude. He didn't speak any English, and his friend had basically brought him in being like, you need to come and see someone. He had been like coughing blood for weeks, and his friend came in and was really worried. And, you know, they'd kind of done the whole thing where they sat around and someone had called their name and they hadn't heard, and now they'd booked back in, and it was like 7 hours down the line, and his friend had been up all night with him, and he had to go to work in the morning, and the patient was just like the most grateful person ever. Like, the second I kind of like take my stethoscope off to, like, you know, before I've even been like, I'm gonna examine you, he's already like whipping up his shirt and standing to attention, and, you know, really sweet and trying to be really helpful and trying to, you know, and not at all frustrated or angry, even though the friend was a bit frustrated initially. And as I sort of took the history, I kind of, like, this really sad picture kind of evolved of just how he was living in a warehouse, and, you know, how, what, he used to have a job and he used to have all these things, and how that all kind of dropped out. And, you know, and all these things. And I remember then going and looking him up on our system and finding, like, all these issues, and he'd previously had TB and had it treated, and his x-rays were just the most horrific thing I've ever seen. I was looking at them and I was like, oh my God. And I just remember feeling like, as I was examining him, I just remember feeling like it's like he had lost any sort of sense of ownership over himself. He kind of was very just kind of like at the whim of this world. And it was, but in the most like innocent way, he was kind of had this childlike innocence to him, in the way that he was like, he had come and he was like willing to do these things. And you know that, like, if he was diagnosed and started on treatment, like, he would take all his treatment, but he would go back to the same situation and it would probably all happen again. And I think that attitude, like, as I was literally examining his chest, it just really overwhelmed me. And I just cried, like, secretly whilst I was listening to the back of his chest, and then, like, quickly, like, wiped my tears and turned back and was like, okay, we're going to do X, Y, and Z. Because I felt like it wasn't my place to be, like, sobbing about him to him. Yeah. So I secretly cried. And then I just remember feeling really sad and thinking about him and being like, it's such a shame that despite his best intentions, like, that the system has
failed him.
Yeah, the system has failed him, and the circumstances around him are kind of like a noose around his neck. And how many times is he going to experience this until this becomes too severe and too significant, and, you know, what goes on from there. But with Maya's new project, you know, hopefully that will not be an issue as much.
And can I just ask, Maya, clearly that story was really difficult for Suba to deal with at the time, and I think it would have been very difficult for all of us. With the camp in Lesbos, surely that's an experience that you have with pretty much every patient that you come across.
Yeah.
How do you develop your own, like, resilience, or what do you need to do to prepare yourself before you go and work in these camps?
You definitely need kind of an inner strength. The stories that you hear are stories that you never even thought human beings could do those kind of things to each other. It's really, really heartbreaking. That, like you were saying, how grateful this patient was, that is something that I will never forget from those camps, that they would come and they would wait for hours and then they'd see me and I literally could do the very, very basic thing for them. And they were so grateful. And it makes you feel so humble. It makes you feel like, I don't really know what I've done here. I've taken so much more from them than they have from me. So you have to mentally prepare yourself that it's something that is going to be completely out of your comfort zone. When I got back, I needed to do a lot of reflecting to kind of think, how am I going to move? You know, what am I going to do about this? It really, really stays with you. But what stays with you more is their resilience, their strength. Because they're not only grateful for you, they help each other. They're creating this community there that somehow works. I don't really know how, but it's an amazing experience. Like I said, it's you don't really understand where it comes from, where the strength comes from, but it's just there. You just see it. I guess that's what I took away from it. Yeah.
I think that's a good answer. It's difficult, isn't it? So just because we're coming towards the end of the interview, even though we could keep talking for ages, which I'm sure we will straight after this, because we're all way too chatty anyway. Maya, if other people wanted to get involved in working in refugee camps or working in resource poor environments, what would you advise them? How would they go about even researching it?
Mm-hmm, yeah, so there's the way I did it was I just searched through Facebook and through Google to see what NGOs were working in the area. There's obviously the big NGOs like MSF and MDM, but they usually take people who are a bit more senior than me. And I think it's paid jobs. I don't think they have any volunteers. So if you want to volunteer for a short period of time, there are a lot of NGOs that are looking for people. You just go onto their websites, you find out what they're doing. They also do search and rescue and activities with children in the other camp. Mm-hmm. So it's not just medics that they're looking for. There's lots of other kind of useful skills that people can bring to the table. So just research, basically, volunteers, refugee camp in wherever you want to go, or volunteering opportunities. I would really, really make sure that the NGO that you go with, you research. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of work going out there. There's a lot of work going on there that is, you know, not done the way that it should be done. The humanitarian sector is a little bit messy, a little bit disorganized, like we know from what's been happening in the news. I would definitely research it. I would try and talk to someone who's worked with them before. Before you go, I would make sure it's you're happy with the project and with the organization before you go out. You don't want to get there and realize that, you know, it's not something you're happy with.
Yeah. And can I ask, was there anyone who did go out there and then feel like they needed to return sooner than they could?
I think we were very supportive of each other. That we worked with very closely with translators. Mm-hmm. We lived with the translators. They're all volunteers as well. I think we supported each other. I didn't know anyone that had to go back earlier, but definitely there were breakdowns. We just kind of looked after each other as much as we could. So
thank you so much for sharing with us, Maya.
Thanks for having me.
No, and it's so good to speak to your colleagues outside of work, because I think there's so much that we all do on an individual level that we can really learn from each other. Mm. So I'm even more excited that we even have this podcast to share stories that of the great work that doctors are doing. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Maya's got a great blog. It's called beyondthebedside.blog. Subu, would you be able to read out a passage from one of her blogs that she wrote?
Yeah, please.
Okay.
Pressure's on.
Okay, so here is an excerpt from Maya's blog, Beyond the Bedside. Many patients asked me to help them forget the horrors that constantly haunted them. In particular, they needed something to help them sleep. They were simply asking for a way to continue existing. I couldn't offer anything. Medications for insomnia, anxiety, and depression cannot be routinely used in a camp like Moria. This is partly due to the extremely high risk of intentional overdose, but also because desperation in the camp is so severe that the availability of such medications would probably drive a black market leading to violence. Luckily, inspirational work is being done by small NGOs, such as the provision of classes, English and Greek, IT, stress relief, and many more, as well as hosting events and activities to encourage integration and well-being for the refugees on the island. Everyone working in the clinic promoted these programs heavily, and we found the benefits were remarkable.
Okay, so I wrote this blog shortly after I came back from working in Moria. So as of 2015, the number of forcibly displaced people, more than 65 million, has reached its highest since the end of the Second World War. Through sheer good fortune, most of us will never know how it feels to live in fear or to be forced to flee our homes and everything we know surge of safety. The poem Home by Worsaw Shire begins with, "No one leaves home unless home is the mouth of a shark." So let me say to those who have asked me if the solution is just to let anyone in, please think. Think about your question, about your situation, and then think about theirs. Think about the fact that the only difference between you and a refugee is the piece of land that you were born in. Had history followed a different route, it could have been any one of us behind those fences trying to get in. We as individuals can do little to change the incredibly complex situation in Syria and the rest of the world. But I think that our attitude, our sense of entitlement, and our lack of gratitude for what we have is something we can and should be prepared to challenge. We live in one of the richest and most developed countries in the world, yet we lack the collective responsibility and a sense of community to end homelessness, to care for our elderly population, and to stop teaching our children that success is measured in personal achievement, fame, or money.
Little round of applause, silent round of applause.
I know. There's not really much we can add to that, is there now?
No, I think that was a beautiful note to end this episode on. I think we've spoken about some amazing things. Thank you so much, Maya.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, that was so cute, wasn't it? I loved it.
It was.
So thank you guys for listening as always. I hope you're enjoying our new series on interviews with doctors who are doing some great work across the UK and abroad, as you've heard today. And Suba, do you want to finish with?
Yeah, our usual round off, which is please always like, subscribe, comment, give us a 5-star rating. If you're going to give us a 1-star rating, just don't do one.
In fact, stop listening. That's where you're at.
Listening begrudgingly. Yeah.
We also always love it when you guys interact with us on Instagram. I know that we were recently asking you about who else you want us to bring on the show, and that's been interesting. Sande. I mean, who's got those kind of connections? Exactly. Please.
Because we certainly don't.
Yeah.
So I think it'd be really nice to round off this episode, maybe with a tune from Maya's band, Pocket Satellite.
Please, Maya, can we?
I absolutely love her band. I play her music on my Spotify, on the ward, and everyone loves it. The only person who cringes is Maya. So I think
she's like blaring it out while we're doing discharge summaries. It's just like, oh, gosh.
So that's how we'll finish the episode. I hope you guys enjoy. Thank you. Bye.
To lay upon the shore while the horizon breaks away, and there are many miles my boat must take, and that I'll hand it over when the winter melts away. I'll get a new set of instructions, and there'll be no time to stay. It's been a pleasure just to meet you. I could use you in my crew too. Oh. Enough supplies of matches for a month or two, I'd say. We take no prisoners anyway, unless the captain chooses you. There is nothing I can do. Thank you.
and canoe. Sail away until we're through.
Today's episode was recorded at Mare Street Market.
Catch us over on www.afterthelettersmarket.com or /afterthelettersmarket on every social media network.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.